In the year 589 BC, which is a long time ago, the kingdom of Judah got caught up in the politics of the Middle East. And they sided with Egypt against Babylon. That caused a large Babylonian army to come out of the east and occupy the kingdom of Judah and besiege the city of Judah, or Jerusalem, to besiege the capital city of Judah, which was Jerusalem. To take a walled city in the ancient world was not an easy thing to do, especially a city as big as Jerusalem. And part of the challenge for the besiegers was keeping its army supplied during the siege. Normally, armies marched and fought during the late spring, the summer, and the early fall, but in the wintertime, they disbanded. The soldiers went back home to be reconstituted again the next spring. And the reason they did this was because it was very difficult to supply armies in the wintertime when there was no food. And that works fine for regular campaigns, but it doesn't work for a siege. Because as soon as you break the siege by sending your soldiers back home again, the besieged force sets out about repairing the damage and restocking the food supplies for next year. So that when the besieging army returns in the spring, they have to start all over again. In a siege, the fundamental question at hand is which side will run out of food first? The besieging army on the outside or the besieged army and population on the inside? It was a test of will, of endurance, of resources. So when the siege by the Babylonians began in 589 BC, the citizens of Jerusalem had reasonable confidence in the strength of their walls and in their own resources. And they believed they had a very good chance to outlast the Babylonians. And they also trusted in the promises of Egypt to come to their rescue. And so the siege of Jerusalem went on month after month after month after month. Egypt never did fulfill its promises to come to their rescue. The siege went on for 30 continuous months, unheard of in the ancient world. 2.5 years into the siege, the Babylonians broke through the main wall of the city, and they burned Jerusalem to the ground. They destroyed the temple of God. And they toppled the walls of Jerusalem so that they could never do this again. And finally, they sent a great portion of the population off into exile. So long, Judah. Goodbye, Judah. The people of Judah spent 48 years in exile. They spent this time in part lamenting their condition. See, the people were hugely dispirited. We know this from the writings of several of the prophets who lived during this time: Zephaniah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Obadiah, Habakkuk. Plus, the last third of Isaiah also focuses on the plight of those living in exile. And some of the Psalms are from this period as well. One of the most famous is Psalm 137. This is a song of lament. It's been made famous to us by Boney M. Remember the song "By the Rivers of Babylon"? It's a very popular song in the late 70s. My dad used to listen to it all the time. You know, "By the Rivers of Babylon." I never really liked it at the time, But this is how Psalm 137 goes, at least the opening part. It says this: "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. Zion was the hill on which the temple was built. It could sometimes stand for the temple. It sometimes stood for Jerusalem as a whole. So by the rivers of Zion, Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion.' How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you. if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy? How did a song about a people shunted into exile become a big pop hit, do you suppose? I mean, it's got that funky disco beat. If you've ever listened to it, it originally was a reggae song, actually, and it was turned into disco by Boney M. But the song itself is about a people dispossessed of their inheritance. It's about a people who struggle to survive living in a foreign land, far from where they want to be. It's a song about people who have fallen into a ditch and can't get out again. How does that kind of song become a big pop hit, do you suppose? But maybe that is its appeal. Because I think we all understand what it means to live apart from where we want to be. We all understand what it means to live apart from who we want to be with. We all know what it means to find ourselves at times in life in the ditch. There is a real sense of longing in Psalm 137, a pining for something that was lost, a pining for a past that had what was wanted, a pining for a better time and place, for a golden age, so to speak. It's like the person who has had everything in life and then loses it all in a quick succession of events, and now they are left bereft of something hugely important to themselves. Do you think people get more sentimental as they get older? What do you think? I've been wondering about that lately myself. I've been noticing a creeping sentimentality coming into my heart, into my makeup. Does that come with older age? I suppose it does. When I was young, I had no patience for sentimentality, no patience for nostalgia. Today, I'm not sure what to think about it, honestly. Maybe sentimentality is a necessary byproduct of living in this mortal world. As time goes by and we see the relentlessness of change go by in front of us and we see things or people important to us disappear, perhaps it's completely understandable that a certain sentimentality builds up in us, a certain nostalgia for what used to be. I think everyone here is old enough to have experienced profound loss in life. I think everyone here today probably knows what it means to live by the rivers of Babylon. It's because loss comes in many forms. It could be a person or a place or something. It could be a unique one-time gathering of people that we treasured. It could be a special event or a state of being. It was there for us and now it's gone. Often, it's only when that person or place or thing disappears, when that unique gathering of people ends, or when that blessed state of being falls away or is lost to us, that we fully come to recognize just how important he or she or it was to us, how privileged we were that we had it. Got me thinking about this guy, Michael, that I'd seen on a YouTube video. He lost something super important to him. To himself in life, and he never got over it. And I thought maybe we could watch, it's just only 2 minutes long, we could watch a little video about him.
You're homeless here in Traverse City. Tell me about it.
What do you want to know?
Well, where are you sleeping at?
Wherever I can.
So what's a day like? What's a night like?
The day is pretty good because I go out see my friends. Go out, have meals, but the night gets pretty cold because it's still early yet.
How'd you end up on the streets?
I lost my son when he was 5 and a half. And I just lost everything. It's all right. And I asked my family for nothing.
How long have you been sleeping outside?
What year is it? 2017? About 10 years now.
Oh my gosh, that's too long. That's way too long.
I've had jobs. I work and I do everything I can, but can never get a place around here. I travel down south in the wintertime because it's too cold here.
If you had 3 wishes, what would they be?
I only need 1. I want my son back. That's it. I don't like talking about my son. Sorry.
Thank you very much for talking.
Thank you.
I've watched that a number of times. It kind of chokes me up a bit. Michael's a guy who lives by the rivers of Babylon in the loss of his son. And you know, it's amazing how a broken heart can overturn a life. And I can completely understand how a deep loss can lead to ruin or to ruins. You know, there have been times in my life where I've been very close to God. I could feel the power of God's Spirit in me, and I had this deep sense of joy and peace. And then it goes away. Something changes, and I don't understand it. And I long again for that intimacy with God. I think everyone here knows what it means to have a real connection with a certain person, a certain link of intimacy, but then things change. And we often want that connection back with that person. And we don't know how to go about getting it back. We don't know how to go about it at all, really. And sometimes it seems it's not even possible for us to get it back in this life, at least. People lived by the rivers of Babylon, and they lived in the ruins of their circumstances, and they licked their wounds as people do, and they tried their best to remember a time when they were truly God's people. And then a day comes like any other. And a herald of Cyrus, the new great king, Persian king, arrives to the people of Judah. And this herald reads the great king's edict and announces to them that they can go home. The ban on their return has been lifted. And I wonder what that moment must have felt like when the news of the king of Persia filtered through the people of Judah, when the people of Judah fully understood the implication of the great king's edict for them. And I don't think it takes a great deal of imagination to envision that moment. The edict must have been received with an initial shock, a moment of disbelief, but then there must have been this time of great celebration, of joy, of the joy of a people who have digested the news that they can go home. They can go back home again. The great comeback begins for them. And so they set off, many, many thousands of them. And when they finally get back to the land of Judah, what do they discover? They discover that it isn't anything like they remembered. See, the Babylonians had done a great job in destroying everything. The whole land is in ruins. The Jerusalem that they knew was gone. The temple that they had worshipped God in for 400 years was a bunch of rubble. And what they remembered and what they found were two completely different realities. The vision in their hearts and the reality before them couldn't be more different. And you get a real sense of this in Ezra's recounting of the laying of the foundation stone of the new temple. There's this big ceremony, and the priests are present in their fine vestments, and the trumpets are ready to blare, and the Levites, who are the worship leaders of the temple, have their cymbals and drums ready to go. And everything is done according to the traditions that King David had given to the people of Israel. And remember, David had been the one who was instrumental in getting the original temple built. And Ezra says that with praise and thanksgiving, they sang to the Lord. He is good. His love towards Israel endures forever. And this was the Israelites, now the one tribe of Judah's version of the goodness of God that we sang today. And then we get this really fascinating scene unfolding, because as the foundation stone is laid, there is this great shout of praise for the Lord. This unfolding joy runs through the crowd gathered there, but there's also a great sound of weeping, of crying and deep sadness in the crowd. You see, there are many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen and remembered the old temple, the first temple, the original temple. They had moved in that original temple. They had worshipped in that original temple. These were people who were present when that original temple was the center point of the life of Judah. And they were amidst a group of people who had never seen the original temple before at all. Most of the people in that crowd were born after the destruction of the temple and the laying and burning of Jerusalem. So they had no idea what had been lost. After all, the laying of the foundation stone for the new temple was about 50 years after that first or original temple had been knocked down. As I said, most haven't even been born. Most of the people in the crowd hadn't even been born when this moment had come about 50 years earlier. So this was a moment of great excitement for them, but there were some there who understood what had been lost. And they also knew whatever that new temple would become, it would never replace the genius and the brilliance of the original. And you get this strange moment where there is great shouts of joy mingled with deep sounds of weeping and sadness. Ezra says this, "No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise and the sound was heard far away." We've been talking about rebuilding from ruins. That's the theme for the last 2 weeks today and the next 2 weeks. How everything in life ends up in ruins. It's inevitable for us as mortal creatures. It's part of what it means to be a mortal creature. Nothing that we create will ever survive forever. There is nothing in this world that will endure forever. And sometimes we live in exile like Michael. And all we want is the world that we once knew. Just want to give it back to us. Just one wish, Lord. Just one wish. That's all we want, is just one wish. That's what the people of Judah were asking for from God. They just wanted one wish. Let us go home, God. Let us go home. And of course, eventually the door opens for them, but they're not exactly going home. Not the home as they once knew it. Because there is no going back in this life. The ruins come to us in life and things end, they get lost, things die, people die, and God will make a way forward for us in the ruins. God will lead us out of the ruins of our circumstances, but it's always a way forward, never a way backwards. It's always a way forward to life, never a restoration of what once was. And that's not always very satisfying. I think many of us are very much like Michael. What we want back is what we have lost. We want the original back. That's our true heart's desire. That's all we want. And I think that's completely understandable. I think we could all relate to Michael's pain and grief. It's totally understandable. Of course we would want what we have lost given back to us. But this is the one thing God will definitely not do for us in this life. Instead, we have to lay the new cornerstones of the buildings that we are going to be called to rebuild from the ruins of our circumstances. We're going to have to lay that cornerstone of something new in our life today. God's calling you and me to build something new. It may harken back to something that was very precious to us. It may be something built on an original design, but it will always inevitably be something new. God is always the God of the new. And rebuilding will bring conflicted emotions to us at times, just like it did to Judah when they laid the cornerstone of the new temple. How can it not bring conflicted emotions, joy and sadness? We rejoice in the newness that is built in our lives, even as we feel deeply the loss of the original. Rebuilding requires laying a lot of new cornerstones in life. It's not a one-time event. We're going to constantly be called by God to lay new cornerstones in our lives. It's a constant day-to-day effort to do this. As things go to ruins, as they inevitably do, we will need to lay new foundations for something new to be built up again. And this will happen over and over again in life. And we will need to constantly allow God to lead us out of the grief of our ruined circumstances so that we are ready to make something new. We're called to learn how to trust in the goodness of God in every moment of life so that we won't need to fear the ruins anymore. The promise that God gives to us in all of this is that we're not alone. You're not alone in this. Someone really is in the fire with you today. Someone is really holding back the sea for you today. And should we ever need reminding of how we've been set free, there is a cross that bears the burden where another died for me. There is a grave that holds no body, and now that power lives in me. I'll count the joy come every battle, because I know that's where you'll be.